This is David Reamer, author of Get Your Startup Story Straight, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection in invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome David Reamer to talk about his book, Get Your Startup Story Straight, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs, published by River Grove Books. David Reamer has worked in the center of the global hub of innovation, the San Francisco Bay Area, for most of his professional life. He has spent 40 years telling stories as a marketing and advertising executive at J. Walter Thompson, Yahoo, and several startups. Today, he is an executive in residence at Berkeley Haas School of Business, advising teams at Bay Area accelerators and running storytelling training at Google, SAP, Salesforce, Netflix, Bose, Kaiser Permanente, and Abbott Labs. He holds a BA from Brown University and an MBA from Columbia University. And interesting fact, he produces theater and serves as chair of the board of the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. David, congratulations on Get Your Startup Story Straight and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be a part of this amazing journey that you're on. And I'm enjoying just being here today.
Super. Now, another interesting fact is that you and I both worked at the same ad agency in the same building at the same time in New York back in the late 1980s.
Amazing that that's a fact, and I'm glad we discovered it before this call so we could sort of refresh our memories about that moment in history.
Well, yeah, and I was able to contact a lot of people that we know in common and ask them not to tell the truth about what happened back then. I mean, there's a lot of things I did when I was younger that I'm not proud of, and all those charges were dropped. So I don't remember ever interacting with you. But I remember you and who you were. Now, I'm not saying that, like Ron Burgundy, you had many leather-bound books and your apartment smelled of rich mahogany. But even back then, David Reamer was
kind of a big deal.
And as I mentioned, you serve as chair of the board of the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco.
Yep.
So be honest. When you're having those black tie gala fundraisers, do you serve rice-a-roni?
Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat.
I'm sure they used to, but we no longer serve that at our big fancy events.
Oh, man, I've always wanted to find out about that. Okay. Well, in the foreword to your book by your friend and Brown University classmate, John Klein, former CNN president too, right?
Yeah. He's had an amazing career. So I was really pleased he was willing to write that for my book.
Yeah, he wrote about something. We're not going to go into this too much in the book, but it was something that I just laughed out loud, and I wish more people would understand it. And doggone it, I'm going to read it. It says, when David was a hotshot advertising executive at J. Walter Thompson, I would toss him grabby slogans he could use for his Sprint or IBM accounts. And he would patiently explain that the catchphrases come last. First comes a deep understanding of the customer those companies are trying to reach, what they need, and how the product meets that need. Figure that out, and the words will flow. Oh, be still my beating heart. It just warmed the cockles of my heart when he said that.
Well, it was great that he even remembered that, right? I mean, that goes back, when I was working on the Sprint account, which is when we had those conversations. It was the early 90s. So we're talking, 30 years ago, and he still remembers the lesson that I gave him about how we develop advertising. And, you and I were both brought up on the Thompson Way.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we were indoctrinated. And you know, when you ask the question for me to think about influences, it's one of my major influences. We were trained on how to think about developing a story that you share in a 30-second or 60-second message or in any form of communications. And so he took that lesson to heart, I guess.
Well, I loved it. And, you know, there's one dirty little secret about your book, though, David. We got to get this out of the way. The book subtitle mentions innovators and entrepreneurs, but the dirty little secret is that this book applies to anyone who is trying to persuade. Seriously, and that could be like a parent or a teacher or a salesperson or a politician.
No question. I mean, it, you know, what's interesting about the process that I went through in writing this book is, you know, I've spent a long time working with people who are creating new things, usually in the form of a startup or, mm-hmm. or an entrepreneur within a company or a product manager in a company. But when you think about most of the work that you have to do to influence and persuade is around something new. Right? There's some new method that you want to do something within your company. There's a new organization you want to introduce to your community. There's a new social justice platform you want to advance. There's a new product you're creating. There's a new business you want to start. The key word in all of those frameworks is new.
Well, yeah. And if it's not new, well, there's a problem.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, what makes it interesting is that it's new. And so I thought about writing this book from the perspective of how do you weave a framework? How do you build a narrative around something new? And then how do you use storytelling techniques to make it compelling to people with a notion on new? So yes, anybody who's listening to this, who's working on a new product or a new program or a new service or even just a new way of doing things, this book could be useful.
So I'm not in the startup world, really. We don't work with startups, but I was all over it. So I don't know, just a focus group of one there.
I've heard this from others too, Doug. I mean, there's several people who have a background in marketing, and they've said, you know, even though maybe this wasn't your core target audience, it's incredibly helpful to me.
Yes, yes. So I want to read an excerpt from the very beginning, and then we'll dive in. So on page 2. Get your startup story straight is for entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs looking to solve problems or create something new. You could be solving a business problem, developing a new product or service, or creating a new way for your organization to conduct business. It's a how-to book that walks you through the steps of building and telling a story. It helps structure your thinking and forces you to deeply understand your customers and pinpoint how your innovation will improve their lives. In the book, I will talk about the essential elements that compose a good story. I'll share examples of innovators who were particularly good at understanding and sharpening their story, and maybe some who weren't. The cases will include businesses large and small, as well as institutions and nonprofit organizations. And then moving on, you write, in Act 1 of Startup Story, I share how you can dramatically improve your product and business by seeing the world through the lens of a strong narrative. You will be better equipped to grasp the relationship between your customer and your service, enabling you to better focus your product development efforts. In Act 2, I demonstrate how storytelling techniques enable you to talk clearly about your innovation and inspire others to become wild fans of it, be they customers, investors, or employees. In Act 3, I share a few common innovation story archetypes that might resonate with your own innovation story. If one of these archetypes feels familiar to your story, you can use it to jumpstart your narrative. If you are reading this book to enhance your pitches, you'll be glad you did. But you should also use this book to learn how to use a story to guide your product strategy and shape your company. After all, you can't tell a great story unless you have a great story to tell. You need to be sure that you have all the necessary elements of a compelling product story in place before you can develop exciting ways to tell it. Get Your Startup Story Straight helps you build that story and make it magical.
I should have had you read my my audiobook. That sounded great.
Well, I can only do it for short periods of time.
Oh, okay. Anyway, it came across really well.
Well, thank you. Well, you write on page 11 that Pixar, and I should add, since we're old JWT hands, when I worked on the Listerine account at J. Walter, when you might have been there, we were using this company called Pixar before they ever did movies. Remember the commercials with the bottles of Listerine boxing and swinging through vines?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was really something to see how successful they became. And when I was on the Toys R Us account, we had them do commercials. And I like to think, oh, maybe they learned how to render toys while doing the Toys R Us advertising for us. Happy to play a small part, a legend in my own mind. So anyway, you write that Pixar typically takes up to 5 years making a film, and at least 4 of those just working out the story. That blew me away. So I realize the question I'm about to ask is something like, what is the meaning of life? But David Reamer, why do stories matter so much?
Well, we literally have evolved to respond to story. There's all sorts of evidence now, especially as we've done deeper studies of how the brain works, that we've as a species, we've separated ourselves from other species. Other species could communicate, but we're a species that was able to start to talk about what might happen in the future. Like, be careful about going around that corner, because you never know what's on the other side. You might run into that same mountain lion that took out, our buddy here. Mm-hmm. And the ability to share stories is something that that we've evolved to enable us to do the things we've been able to do, to form civilizations, to form communities, and to advance what we do and to build new things based on the knowledge of people who came before us. And because we've done that, the emotional centers of brain and the memory of the brain are linked. So people are more likely to remember something in the form of a narrative. And if they feel it emotionally, they're far more likely to act on it. And there's all sorts of evidence of that. So stories really matter. And anybody who's trying to get something new off the ground, they have to get their customer, or they have to get the investor they're talking to, or the person they're selling to, they have to get the person on the other side to feel what their customer is feeling, so that they can help create a narrative of why they really need this thing I'm creating, so that when I create it, the product's a hero that saves the day. And just as humans, we've evolved to respond to that form of structure. We're more likely to remember it. We're more likely to relate to it. And we're more likely to want to root you on and say, yes, let's do that, and give you what you need to do what you have to do to get it done, whether it's my business or whether it's my money or anything that you're trying to accomplish as the storyteller.
Great. And back to Pixar, you mentioned that Andrew Stanton, who's one of the premier writers and directors at Pixar, has perhaps the simplest directive for building stories: just make me care. I love that. And actually, on the same page you write, every great story has a protagonist whose motivations we fully understand. Now, I got to ask, because of your background in theater, you write that there's a rule in musical theater, which is to include an I want song that the protagonist must sing in the first 20 minutes of the show. Why is that?
Yeah, so the audience knows who they're rooting for and what they're hoping for them to accomplish. Musicals are such an extraordinarily bizarre art form, because people are speaking in the way we normally speak, and then all of a sudden they break into song. So when you're experiencing that as an audience, and you're going, what the heck is going on? I mean, they just started singing. It's this elevated art form, and you really have to lean into it and want to know, well, why am I here, and why do I care about this person who just started singing? So if we're not clear about who they are and who I'm supposed to be focusing on and what their intention is, what they're trying to accomplish, and then what's standing in their way, what's the obstacle, if I don't sort of have all those elements, it's really hard to get my footing and want to follow this crazy thing that I'm watching. So there's this unwritten rule that the character needs an I want song, where they describe, what it is they're hoping to accomplish, whether they're trying to break out and discover who they really are, or whatever the narrative is, there's something that we have to hear from that protagonist early in the show. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason I included it in the book is it's a great lesson for anybody building what I call an innovation narrative. Mm-hmm. In that they have to be clear about who the protagonist is. They have to know what segment they're targeting this thing for. I don't have to go down to the individual when I'm building structure, but I do need to know, something about the segment I'm focusing on, and understand them deeply and understand what they want pretty early on in the story. Otherwise, I'm not going to be really interested in what you've introduced to help that person out with your new product or service. So it might be fun to go back to your Andrew Stanton thing about Make Me Care, because there's a great story in the book about even a great storyteller like Andrew Stanton struggled when he was building the narrative for Finding Nemo. I don't know if you remember that, yes. that part of the book. But the story goes something like this. And they talk about it at Pixar now. It's now part of one of their storytelling courses. They actually talk about this moment. So in Finding Nemo, the original premise was, he thought it would be really clever, Andrew did, if there were flashbacks throughout the film. And it was only at the very end of the film there was the flashback of what happened when his wife's nest was attacked by a barracuda and all the eggs were eaten and his wife was killed. This is Marlin, I'm sorry, the protagonist in the story. Marlin is the father of Nemo. And everybody's dead except for this one egg that becomes Nemo. And in the first version that they put together, that was at the end of the film. So when they showed this version with flashbacks to the brain trust, the creative brain trust, it turns out nobody liked Marlin. They thought he was kind of jerky and overprotective. So they then said, you know what?
Understand why he was overprotective.
Right. They didn't understand why he was overprotective. Uh-huh. He just seemed like this kind of like, who is this hovering father? And then they're like, oh, you know what? Let's get rid of the flashbacks and let's take that scene where he loses everything and put that at the beginning of the movie. And now everyone's going to empathize with him and know why Nemo's so important to him. And they made that change and it changed everything. And so here's even the greatest people in the world at making stories. I mean, their product is a story. That's the output of their assembly line is a story. Mm-hmm. Even they have to work it over and over again to make sure they've got the story structure straight so that they can then turn that into the compelling movie we see.
Yes, it's not just lightning in a jar that they suddenly capture and then put in the theaters. So you mentioned the innovation story. Let's talk a little bit more of that. Explain what you mean when you write, now listen to the order, listener, to build a strong product strategy, you need a strong innovation story.
Yeah. Well, so what's so interesting about this work that I've been doing now for really well over a decade, sort of at this stage in my career, I started working with startups, is when I would start talking to people about how to tell the story, I would realize as I worked through it with them that we were literally evolving the story itself as we started working on it. In other words, they didn't always have, and most people when they're starting out building something new, they haven't nailed the story yet, that meaning they haven't figured out, well, who really needs this the most? Who's that core target audience that I'm building this for? And what are the issues that they have, both mm-hmm. sort of in general in life, and then maybe specifically around the thing that I'm going to help them with? And not just the functional needs they have, but what are the emotional things that is going on, right? And when you dig into all that, what sometimes happens is you actually change either the person you're targeting your solution for, or you change the problem you're setting out to solve. And as a result, the product itself changes.
Uh-huh.
So this whole notion that we build these narratives and we should work on these narratives to first make sure we've got the right story to tell, if we really do that discipline well, then the creation of the story is so much easier and it's far more likely to be compelling, the storytelling part at the end, because I built it on the right foundation, which is really a strategic exercise even more than a communications exercise.
It's like you're sneaking in the strategy.
Yeah, and it's a great discovery because people almost don't even realize that's what's happening because they're coming to me saying, help me tell my story, David. And it's like, all right, well, let's make sure we have the right story in the first place, and then we go through the exercise, and inevitably it evolves during that process.
Yes, and because you're an old ad guy like me, it brings to mind the Palmolive commercials where they have Madge, and she says, you're soaking in it. They don't even realize that you're stirring the strategy drink, and they think, oh, this is about storytelling. So that was my take.
I can't tell you how many times, Doug, I use that expression, you're soaking in it.
Oh, good. This is turning into a support group, David.
Yes, exactly. No, we're of a certain age, the two of us, and that commercial just like has stayed with us, but it's such a great reference point for exactly what you're talking about. When you bring someone along and they don't even realize it, you're soaking in it.
Right. I think maybe a younger group would understand wax on, wax off from The Karate Kid, but even that's probably for the old timers now. So we better move on from this discussion of our age. Specifically, David Riemer, wait just a minute. I'm not a professional storyteller. I don't work at Pixar, although that sounds like fun. And I don't have 4 years to develop my product story. What I want is a simple storytelling framework and some straightforward examples of how to apply it. What say you, good sir?
Yes, that's exactly what's in chapter two of the book, which I know is your favorite chapter, right?
Yes, I already told you that. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So the whole structure, it's you and I, parts of our career, television storyboards were a big deal. We spent a lot of time with them and reworking them. So when I saw this approach of structuring the story based on six frames of a storyboard, I just thought, wow. It's like this guy and I, it's like I worked the same place as this guy. It turns out it's true. But yeah, I want to ask you about the six frames of the storyboard. Could you take us through the six were with the six R, and then I got a couple questions about some of the specifics.
Right. So what I'm going to do as I go through this is I'm going to describe each of the six boxes in this storyboard first, from the standpoint of like a classic story structure. So the first box is the protagonist. And then the translation of that, this is the second thing I'll do, is how to think about it in the context of an innovation narrative. So the protagonist in an innovation narrative is the customer, or the first target customer, or the priority customer segment that you're going for. And we'll talk more about that. The second thing to think about is what is the sort of motivation of the customer? What are their intentions? What's the obstacles, all the stuff standing in their way of what they're trying to accomplish? That's sort of in the parlance of marketing parlance, those are the insights about the customer. Mm-hmm. The third box is where you say, okay, here's the specific problem I'm going to choose to attack. Of all that stuff I just described of what that customer is going through, I'm going to try and solve this particular problem. Mm-hmm. And then I'll dig into that problem. That's the sort of an innovation narrative. It's the problem statement. In a traditional story, you'd call that the conflict. What's right. The conflict the character is facing? In the second, and so that's the setup to the story. The first three boxes are the story setup. So now you've got your audience going, okay, I know who this is for. I know what they want and what's making it hard. I know what specific thing you're going to try and fix for them. Great. Now go tell me how is their life better, and how did you fix it? And now we're into the second part of the storyboard. So box number three is the value proposition. You know, we used to call that the benefit statement back in the day. But it's, you know, how is my life different and better now that I'm using this thing? And in the parlance of a classic story, that's sort of like it's the I want bit, right? It's like, right. This is what my life will be like if I get what I want.
Aspirations, yeah.
The aspirations. And then the fifth box is where we finally introduce the product. The product is the hero. So it comes in this part of the story where I've got that great setup. I know what the customer wants. I know how their life will be better if I fix this problem for them. And now I tell them how I do it. And this is sort of the context of a traditional story, it would be sort of the rest of the plot of the story. It's how the rest of the movie would play out if we're watching a movie. Mm-hmm. But in this context, it's where we talk about the product. What's the product description, and can I describe the product pretty simply in three key points so the audience could not only understand it, but remember and maybe share it with someone else because I came up with a very succinct way of talking about the product. And then finally, the last thing I do is I just want to do a check. The last box is like a check to say, is this thing that I just solved, did I do it better than other things that are already out there? You know, because what typically happens when you introduce an innovation story to an audience, what they're thinking is, they're thinking about their frame of reference, and they're thinking, oh, I already have something that solves that problem.
Have I seen you before?
Have I seen you before, yeah. Right? This is familiar. So you have to somewhere in that storytelling, whether it's the end or somewhere early on, introduce the fact that every story takes place in some context, in some setting. It's the world of the story. And I have to be clear about the world of the story in this context so I can be sure to make sure that I'm differentiated and better than the other things out there. So that's the storyboard.
Great. So let me just jump into a couple things about the customer. And you talked about how, I guess this is where you've seen lots of companies get tripped up. They say, well, what if we're selling to multiple people, or what if we're not selling to the end user? You had a very interesting solution, which is feature the person who has the greatest pain and the most to gain, the simplest way to choose a protagonist.
Yeah, it's what I always ask people to fall back on if they're struggling with that question.
Well, who else do they tend to want to talk about, like the channel?
They might want to talk about the channel. And this is always an interesting question, and I have this with sales forces a lot, where they're wondering, do I tell the story from the lens, through the lens of the person buying the product for me, or from the lens of the person who's going to use it in the company if it's not the person buying it, which is in many cases the case in B2B. But there are often some examples in B2C where maybe it's a ed tech solution, and the parent is buying it, but it's for the kid. Do you tell it through the lens of the parent or the kid? If in the case of a high tech solution, you might have someone in IT who's buying the product, but the person who's using it is a data scientist down the line in the organization. So where do you choose to tell the story? It's usually best, not always the case, but most often the case, it's the person who has the greatest pain is the end user. And if the person buying the product for the end user understands what they're going through, that end user is going through, and a parent would understand what their kid's going through, an IT person should understand what that data scientist issues are, because they're banging on their door saying, get me a solution for this, Mr. Mm-hmm. IT or Ms. IT person. So in that context, usually it's the end user who has the greatest pain. Sometimes it's not, but that's where I usually lean. And if I could just say one more thing about this, sometimes it's a channel question, but sometimes it's, as you also intimated, it's a segment question. I sell this into lots of different segments. Either you want to find what's the commonality between the segments, because often there's some commonality, especially with something new that's really new that's being created. You want to find the segment that's going to embrace it first, because you got to sell it to that first most needy segment so that they like it. And then you look for other people like that. You look for like profiles, and then you start to sell it to other people who have a similar kind of life experience or work experience as that first target customer. But it's hard to build a great product if you're building it for, quote, oh, well, anybody can use this. Well, how do you build a product for anybody? And how do you tell a compelling story if the protagonist is anybody? As I'm hearing you tell the story of this great innovation, I have to start to picture the person who's going to use it. Mm-hmm. And if that picture is too fuzzy, then I never get grounded in understanding the narrative that you're telling me.
Yes. So let's talk about second of the blocks on the storyboard. And this is the customer insights, the intention and obstacles. Now, David Reamer, I'm going to play the audio from a Reese's Puffs commercial and ask you to explain what that has to do with gaining customer insights. And just so the listener knows, this commercial was mentioned in the book.
Hi, I want to apply for a driver's license.
What do you really want?
To be able to legally drive a car.
What do you really, really want?
I want my independence.
What do you really, really, really want?
To show my parents that I can solve my own problems, that I don't want their help. Truth is, they need me more than I need them.
What do you really, 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 really want?
I want Reese's Puffs, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
Next!
Reese's Puffs is what you really, 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 really want.
Take it away.
So that's one of my favorite commercials, maybe ever.
I have a feeling I'm going to be using that again in the future for presentations.
It's so brilliant. I mean, I'll start with answering your question. What that commercial is telling us is that the best way to understand what people really, really, really want is just keep asking them.
Yes.
Just keep saying, and why is that? And why is that? Well, yes. Why do you feel that way? Well, why do you feel that way? And eventually you unpeel the onion far enough so you get to the magical part of the story. Yes. And it's only after you dig far enough, because the customer themselves might not even know what they really, really, really want until you ask over and over again. So anyway, I love that spot. And I have yet to find a better way of demonstrating to people what this is all about, this notion of gaining that really deep emotional insight that drives mm-hmm. the customer's behavior.
Yes, and you mentioned startup guru Steve Blank. He recommended speaking with 100 customers. I thought that was great. But say more about, you know, what is the best way to get these insights beyond speaking to 100 people or saying, you know, why about 5 times like Toyota would have us say?
Yeah, well, it's a listening exercise as much as anything. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of a startup. And again, anybody building a product or anything new, this is relevant to. But this is a startup example. A couple of people coming out of Berkeley, a couple of grad students, had an idea to build what they were roughly calling Yelp for small business. So imagine you're a small business and you want to find someone to do some design services for you, and you would go on this service and it would say, they hear the design firms and hear what people say about them. And that's what they set out to do, right? So they go out and they start talking to customers, to small businesses, you know, bakeries and people who are running companies that, you know, make, you know, small rubber stamps or little print shops or whatever. And they heard the same thing over and over again. As they started to ask people about the problems of services they were trying to bring on to their to help them with their small business. And they all said, you know what, I just want to talk about hiring. And they were like, really? And like, yeah, over and over again, they'd hear, it's so hard for us to find the people we want using the current default method to do that, which is Craigslist. We hate Craigslist. And then they'd start screaming about how awful Craigslist was for this solution, like screaming at them. And so this, you know, Maya and Ben were these co-founders. They said, wait a minute, that's the problem we should solve. Yes. And it was only by just asking them about their experiences of running the business. And they would maybe bring up, yeah, and hiring's hard. Well, tell us why hiring's hard. And then they'd get into the Craigslist problem. And now it's all about Craigslist is terrible. And now they're starting to think, wait a minute, maybe we can be better than Craigslist. And off you go. So just that listening and finding that one thing where you see the person's face contort and you know they're upset. It's like, oh, ask him about that.
Yes. Yeah. Tell me more.
That's another good way to do it.
So you mentioned that one of your mentors in the San Francisco ad business was a dynamo named Steve Darling, who once told you, our greatest human failing is that we forget what we're doing. Explain what he meant.
Yeah, so that was Steve Darland, who ran the office when I first went out to J. Walter San Francisco. And I think what he meant was that we have so much going on in our lives that we sort of forget what's the through line. Like, what's that core thing I should be doing? And one of the powerful things about building a narrative when you're working on something is certainly helpful to you, but it's especially helpful to anybody else who's on your team, whether you have one partner working on something or whether it's an organization of 1,000 people. And that is that if you can have a strong narrative and communicate it, everybody has the same movie playing in their head about who the customer is and what we're doing for that customer. And then it becomes hard for people to forget what they're doing, because they have this strong narrative that they all know, okay, wait, we have to go back to that thing. You know, Jack Dorsey, who co-founded Twitter and Square, he talks about it. He says that we, for our product development work, we literally write little stories. He said they read like plays. They're beautiful, he said. They read like plays. And you follow someone around town and you get to know what their life is like. And the reason he's doing that is he wants everybody who's building a product, in this case he was talking about Square, the payment solution. If you're building a product for a small business that has a cart set up on the street, you want to know about the life of the person running that small business, and you want to know about the life of the person who's coming in and wants to get that little artisan hot dog or whatever they're getting on the side of the street. And by building that narrative, everybody knows how they need to be building the product, and they don't forget what they're doing that way because they've got this strong narrative at the core.
Mm. I apologize. I said Steve Darling. It's Steve Darland. So apologies to Mr. Darland. Last question I want to ask you about the customer insights, which is just, it's such a competitive advantage when you have this kinds of information. But David, why does Jeff Bezos insist on having an empty chair at the conference table whenever he's in a meeting with his executive team?
So this is a great story that I heard from someone who works at Amazon, the customer chair. The whole purpose of that chair is for people to consider the customer in all decisions that they're making as a business. So they literally leave an empty chair at the table. And this happened, I guess, the origin story of that is that there was some meeting going on in the early days, and Jeff didn't feel that the team was really considering the customer. So he walked out of the room, he brought in an extra chair, and he pulled it up to the table. He said, from now on, we're going to have an empty chair at the table, and you're always going to look at that chair and think of the customer. And again, the power of the reason I introduced that into the book is that the biggest message of this book is that you need to really think about your customer being the protagonist in a story and constantly put them at the center of what you're thinking about when you're building what you're building, and then when you're talking about what you're building. And literally at Amazon, they do that through the method of a chair at the table. I do it through teaching you how to build that story where you're constantly grounding it in that protagonist, the customer.
Right. I heard another story that when people are preparing for a meeting with the boss, that somebody will say, oh, wait a minute, you know what? He's going to point at that damn chair again. Oh, the customer. I completely forgot about that. So it becomes the straw that stirs the drink. And it's, I've talked about it in the past, and I love seeing it in the book here. So the third one is the problem definition. And it seems like there could be 100 problems. And one of the challenges is zeroing in on the right problem. Because I think at one point in the book, you talk about how a lot of companies will build some technology in search of a problem. And I was wondering if you could talk about this concept of the ladder of abstraction and how that helps with problem definition. I have to admit, I was not familiar with this.
Yeah. So I learned this myself through teaching in innovation and design programs at Berkeley. So I learned this from other experts on design thinking. But the whole idea is, once we've sort of figured out who the customer is and we've identified a whole bunch of obstacles and challenges, then we have to think about, okay, which problem am I going to attack of all the things I could go after? And I could try and go after something very, very broad or something super specific. One of the examples I use in the book is the story of a guy who wanted to do something in the digital realm to come up with a digital solution to help people, to help doctors. And they came up with an intelligent stethoscope solution. And as they were thinking about exactly how do they want to think about how to optimize what this thing is, they thought, am I trying to make, at the broadest, at the most abstract level, am I trying to help a doctor just have more efficient appointments with their patients and run them through the office faster because they've got this solution that somehow works better? Well, that's really general, and there's a million things that could help them have more efficient appointments with their patients. And then they thought about, well, wait a minute, this technology is great. I could actually help a doctor identify irregular heartbeats with this. And as they thought about that, that's a super specific problem to try and solve. How can I help a doctor better detect these, arrhythmia, for example? And then they thought, well, wait a minute, this solution can actually detect hundreds of heart ailments. So, they came up with a sort of middle ground where they said, how can we help doctors better understand the performance of someone's heart? And that was what they focused on, that statement. And they then built the solution to do that. And the solution is, it's this piece of hardware that takes the heartbeat from an actual regular stethoscope, pumps it into their database, and then in Shazam-like fashion, matches the heartbeat to hundreds of different formats of different kinds of known heart issues, and then sends that information in step number three to either the doctor who knows something about this, or more likely to experts who can look at it and then refine and give feedback on what to do. And that three-step process is what they ended up settling on. But they had to sort of go up and down that ladder of abstraction to land on, let's help doctors, better identify heart issues for patients, regular pediatricians. And the target segment was not experts. It was these regular doctors and children's doctors who weren't great at identifying heartbeats just by listening to them through the stethoscope.
You mentioned moving up and down, and let's talk about that just a little bit more. You write, we move up the ladder of abstraction by asking the question, why is this important? We move down the ladder by asking, what's stopping you? Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So as you move up the ladder, you get to that very, very general thing, which is like, well, doctor's visits aren't very efficient. They're not always accurate. And a generalist doctor can't be an expert on every condition a patient could have. And these are all sort of issues. And you like, how can I help a doctor with that? How can I help a doctor be more efficient or more accurate or have better appointments for their patients? When you get down to that more specific question, what's standing in your way? Well, I can't tell whether the thing I'm listening to is arrhythmia or whether it's a different kind of condition. There's the example that innovator gives when he's talking about the problem he's solving is that there are these two different heart sounds, and he literally says them, plays them out loud, and you can hardly tell the difference between the two. And then he says 4 out of 5 doctors can't tell the difference between these two heart sounds, and one of them is potentially fatal. The point was that was going down to what's standing in their way, and what's standing in their way is A, the ability to recognize the differences, and B, having a knowledge base of all the different kinds of heart sounds, and there's so many that they can't accomplish that, and then that becomes the problem you're solving.
Such a great exercise to go through. I'm glad I found that. Let's talk about the next one, number four, the value proposition or aspiration. And there was a book on the show recently that quoted a study from the Fornays Group that alleged that only 17% of marketers in this one study really understood what a value proposition was, which really troubled me. And I want to quote from page 42. You write, "In a narrative, a character aspires to some outcome. We follow a story to see if the protagonist gets what they want. Likewise, in an innovation narrative, we need to understand the benefit that the customer will experience from our innovation. We call this benefit the value proposition." Can we step back for a second and remind listeners what a value proposition is?
Yeah, it's like your life somehow is different and better after using this new thing. And I want you to tell me how it's different and better. So for example, one of my favorite value propositions is the value proposition for using Evernote, which is remember this. Remember everything. Sorry, it's remember everything. And it's so powerful. Because who wouldn't want to remember everything? Like, that's a great value proposition because it intrigues me. It hooks me. It says, yes, I want that. I want to remember everything. Now, tell me how I do that. And that's when you then describe the product. The product is different from the value proposition, the product descriptor. But I often tell people, just complete the sentence. Now I can blank. What can I do I couldn't do before? Now I can remember everything now that I'm using this product. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful to have a crystal clear, simple value proposition. Because what I find is that most people working on something new want to list a series of benefits, which is great, but I can't remember that. I can't remember five benefits from the different features that you've built. I can remember everything. And then I'll want to know more about how you let me remember everything. And then maybe I'll understand some of the sub-benefits. But that higher order statement is extraordinarily powerful if you can discover it.
Yes, just to underscore, you write, "To derive a strong value proposition, I suggest that innovators try to complete one of the following sentences. Now I can fill in the blank. Or now I can have. There's something you couldn't do before, but now you can." So last question about value propositions. How is a great value proposition like catnip?
It lights up customers. It lights up the people in the business building the solution. It's electric because it gives everybody that incredible focus, and it tells everybody, you know, what we should be focusing on. This is a little bit sort of on this the side of this notion, but one of my favorite examples is a company that was creating a new fashion brand that was an anti-fast fashion brand. So one of the things I talk about in the book is one of the great ways to tell a story is to have an antagonist.
Uh-huh.
Who's the enemy? And then you come along as the hero to smite the enemy, right? So if you were Uber, the enemy would have been taxis. If you were Airbnb, the enemy would have been hotels, right?
Mm-hmm.
For this company, the enemy was fast fashion. And their product was effectively slow fashion, right? It's like they made classic bags and scarves and blouses and sweaters and skirts that could stand the test of time and be in your closet for 3 or 4 or 5 seasons, whereas fast fashion lasts 3 months and then you throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that whole premise, but they hadn't landed on a simple way of defining the value proposition, which is now if you go now you can have, they landed on fewer better things.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer better things. And once they landed on that, it opened all sorts of avenues to them as marketers to build around that notion of fewer better things. They started the notion of a thinner closet, and they encouraged people to send them stuff that they were no longer wearing. And back to this company that wasn't in a business of recycling clothes, but then the company, which is called Cuyana, Cuyana, the company would find homes for those clothes, and they encouraged people to build a wardrobe that was fewer better things. And that particular execution of getting people to engage in that was inspired by having landed on that great language. So sometimes the language as well as the concept of the value proposition just opens things up for the marketer.
Well, looking back, when you hear about a great value proposition, it is sort of like catnip, where you're like, oh, it's a head-slapping thing. Like, oh, of course. Perhaps in your line of work, you hear people say, why didn't anybody think of that before?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go to number five, how the product works, which you call the plot. And you said this might actually be the largest part of the movie, let's say, or the story. But it's my sense that, is this the part that everyone tends to want to go to first?
Yes. And it drives me crazy. And whenever I ask someone to tell me about what they're building, anybody who starts there, I say, stop. I don't tell me about the product, because I don't care. Make me care, right? I don't care yet about your product if I haven't yet learned who is it for, what are their issues, what problem you're trying to solve, how is their life better if you solve it? Great, got all that. Now, how are you doing all that? Now, finally, tell me about the product, because guess what? That's the point where the product can be the hero. We talk about product as hero. Well, how come the product be the hero and come in and save the day if I don't know who it's saving the day for and why they need the day saved?
Yeah, you're not the least bit receptive to this information at this point.
No, I don't care. I don't care. And not only do I want to care intellectually, I want to care emotionally.
Yes.
So what we've all been just talking about is actually everything that has to happen before I get to number five. Right. So when I get to number five, which is the product description, I challenge people to do a couple of things. One, come up with a descriptive line that describes the product, and then tell me three things about what's in the product. So forgive me, I'm going to use my own book as an example. So the box four of my book is actually the title, Get Your Startup Story Straight. That's the value proposition. Now you can get your startup story straight. Box five is the subhead of the book, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs. That's what I've built. That is the thing, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs. And then if I were to describe, well, how do you tell me those three things? How do you tell me about that in sort of three points? I'll say, well, one, I teach you how to build a narrative. Two, I tell you how to tell a story that's based on that narrative in a way that's compelling and emotional and memorable. And three, are there certain kinds of narratives I should look out for that can be guideposts for me that are sort of frameworks or archetypes, if you will, for kinds of stories? And that's what you'll get in this book. So value proposition, product descriptor, and then three points to describe what's in the book. That's what your goal is as a storyteller, to make the product description that simple.
That's terrific. And you also talk about the rule of three, which is a great tip.
Yeah, because I can't remember four. I can remember three things.
And yet we're bombarded with 100.
Yeah. And I, you
on
know,
some
and,
eye chart on a slide.
Yeah, I mean that was the one of the premises of Purple Cow is that you know, Seth's book where he talks about, you know, there's so many more things out there and so many more ways of talking about them and channels through which to talk about them, and he wrote this book many years before all the channels we have now. So we need to have a way to stand out and a way to remember what we're hearing about in that morass of information. And I want someone, when they hear the story of your innovation, I want the audience who heard it to be able to walk out of the room and tell the person at the desk next to them or their partner in their home, I heard about this great thing today and here's how it works. And they can describe it. That's the goal. And if you go beyond three, it's really hard to do that.
Mm, great. So last one, competitive context, which you call the setting. It's my sense that no one wants to talk about their competition or the alternatives that a prospective customer might have. Talk about why it's important to, I guess, you know, address the elephant in the room.
Yeah. Well, I usually suggest that the innovator or the person creating something new, the marketer, whoever's doing it, that they tease some of the alternatives earlier on when they're talking about the insights. Because usually what people don't like about solving the problem today is the ways they have to solve the problem.
Oh, like Craigslist with the small business.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So when I get to the end, it's sort of a check. Have I built something, at least for this segment, that in that case, is better than Craigslist, right? If I'm Uber and I'm focusing on that's a two-sided market. I talk in the book about two-sided markets, Uber, where you have the drivers and the riders. But in the rider's case, have I solved the rider's problem better than a taxi or a black town car, if you remember those from back in the day, or public transportation? Is Uber better than one of those methods for the rider, and why? And then on the other side of the marketplace for the driver, is this the best way for them to make money in a given gig economy if they have a car, and why is this the best way for them to do that if that's their goal, to make a little extra cash in a gig economy? And I have to make sure both of those things come through in the story. Otherwise, as a listener, I'm not going to believe that the customer, the protagonist, is going to get up and move away from the thing they're currently doing to do this, use this new method to make their life easier.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny that, as a lot of listeners probably know, there may be almost 10,000 different marketing and sales software or technology platforms out there. And so I'm hearing about them all the time, and I'm being pitched often. And one of the first things in my subconscious is, well, how's that different from what I'm already using? Yeah. Or, you know, how is that? Do I really have to go investigate that? So that's why it was very appealing to me. So those are the six. And I wanted to jump to the science behind stories, just because I think it's important. And I can remember, you probably know David Acher from Haas.
Yep.
And I've interviewed him a couple times. And I remember in his book, Creating Signature Stories, which was on the show in 2018, he went into great depth about, you know, the science behind why it's so powerful, that even the most logical engineer would start to understand this. And sure enough, you tackled it. You talk about, at first blush, cynics believe that storytelling is a soft skill, but neuroscience is behind the power of stories. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, so much of this is a function of literally how the brain retains and sends messages. You know, there are parts of the brain that literally activate memories based on feeling something, having some emotional connection to something. And think about it, why that's important that we as humans do that. If we didn't do that, we would all be sociopaths or psychopaths. I often forget the difference between the two. But the point is, if you can't look at someone who's struggling with something and not have some emotion that says, oh, that's rough. I can imagine if I were that person, what would that feel like if I were that person? As humans, our brains are set up to make us do that, because if it didn't, we'd all walk around like zombies, not caring about anything that ever happened to anybody and not being able to understand someone else's experience. So if I can leverage that technique in my stories and make my audience feel, like literally themselves feel, what the customer is feeling in a certain situation, and even if they know nothing about what it's like to be that customer, but you're telling a story that makes them feel what that customer is feeling, their brain is going to force them to A, remember it, and B, kind of be on your side to solve the problem, because they don't want to feel that pain that they're feeling the customer is feeling. They want it to go away, just like the customer does. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of leveraging what's already between our ears in terms of using stories.
Yeah, stories were around long before writing was.
Yeah, at the very beginning, it's literally what got our species to evolve and separate and be able to form communities and form civilizations. You know, in the famous book Sapiens, he talks a lot about that in the early part of the book, about how we separated as a species from other even like species that we were evolving, you know, in the parallel paths of Homo sapiens. And then, of course, all the other animals. We were able to communicate a future vision of things in a way that nobody else could, and that could get people to band together to try and accomplish whatever people decided we should try and do, whether it's, you know, defending ourselves or building something better that would help us, or organizing differently. Because if we did, in the future, things would look a little different. That's something we evolved to do. So it's literally in our brains. It's in our DNA.
You came out with both guns blazing here. Even page 20 in the preface, I want to quote from this. You say, there's actual brain science behind why stories are so useful and compelling. Stories are in our DNA. Stories are powerful. In Lisa Cron's great book, Wired for Story, she argues that story is what makes us human. She says, recent breakthroughs in neuroscience reveal that our brain is hardwired to respond to story. The pleasure we derive from a tale well told is nature's way of seducing us into paying attention to it. Story, as it turns out, was crucial to our evolution, more so than opposable thumbs. Opposable thumbs let us hang on. Story told us what to hang on to. Let me just quote from page 76. This is what's so interesting to me. You write, in his book, The Storytelling Animal, Jonathan Gottschall writes, fiction seems to be more effective at changing beliefs than writing that is specifically designed to persuade through argument and evidence. Gottschall cites studies by the psychologists Melanie Green and Tim Brock that argues that stories radically alter the way information is processed. The more absorbed people are in a story, the more that story affects them. Gottschall concludes that when we hear factual arguments, we listen to them with our dukes up. I hope all the marketers and salespeople heard that. He concludes that when we hear factual arguments alone, we listen to them with our dukes up. And then just one other thing I just loved was on next page, you say, to be successful as an innovator, you must convey to your audience what your customer is going through at a visceral level.
Yeah. So,
fantastic. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's so many great books that are being written now on storytelling, and I just tried to source some of the things that really moved me from some of those books. And what I like about that particular example from Jonathan's book is that it resonates, right? When someone's going through a PowerPoint presentation and they're saying, okay, here's this fact, this fact, this fact, point A, B, C, whatever, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, nah, I've seen different data on that. Or I've got a friend who has a different point of view about bullet number two. Or I just don't believe bullet number three. And I'm literally more cynical, right?
Smart says people who?
Are cynical. Yeah. So you're going to start to challenge it in your brain. And that's what you're doing. You're focusing on, you know, you got your dukes up and you're focusing on knocking down this presentation. But if I tell a story and on a visceral level, I'm feeling what the customer is feeling because you've done such a good job of telling me about this person. You know, I tell one of my favorite stories, and I use the narrative storyboard to sort of go through this whole thing in the book, is this story of a woman describing building a solution for Indian people who have left their country and are now living in another country.
Oh, yes.
And are working all the time. The Rodimatic was the product she was creating. Her name was Pranoti Nagarkar. And she goes through and she talks about this thing in a way where I don't know what it's like to be an Indian person living in another country, but she does such a good job of helping me understand some of the guilt that she's feeling as a mother, not giving her kids the same exposure to the culture and the foods that she grew up with in India, because she's living in her case, she was living in Singapore. And I'll never forget her pitch. She told me the story, and by the end of the pitch, I felt like I was that person. And I felt like I was depriving my own children of something culturally because I was now living in this other culture. I was working all the time in this other country. I'm working all the time. And she set out to attack a specific problem that could help that customer. And I wanted her to solve the problem. And the problem was the roti problem. The roti problem is that there are 2.3 billion rotis eaten every day around the world in the Indian community. It's a hugely important part of a meal. It's a flat, round flatbread. And she was feeling like she was depriving her kids because she wasn't up at night making rotis after a long day of working as an engineer in a tech company.
Uh-huh.
So she set out to solve that problem, and I felt that viscerally. And I wasn't intellectually thinking, well, if I'm living overseas, wouldn't I? And I'm not thinking about any – I'm just thinking – wow, that sounds like a real problem. I can just imagine being that person. Tell me how you're going to solve it. And I got absorbed in the story. I wanted her to solve it. She did solve it, and she built this great company. They've sold 70,000 of these things for $1,000 because people are so desperate to connect and stay connected to their culture and give their kids what they had. That's the power of a great story, that you can really feel viscerally what the customer's feeling.
Oh, yes. It was a great story. I started getting hungry just reading about it, and I wasn't even familiar with that. So let's talk about persuasion, okay? On page 78, you write that storytellers' objective is to persuade. And to persuade, you must ensure that your story is, and listen for the rule of three here, memorable, compelling, and clear. So let's talk about that before we wrap up. Let's see here. The very next page, you write, if your audience doesn't remember your pitch, it doesn't matter how compelling your product is. One of the best ways to ensure your audience remembers your story is to make them feel something. So what are some of the ways, like we just talked about, to make that emotional connection that provides the direct link to memory?
Yeah, I think there's lots of methods I describe in the book. The first mm-hmm. one is if you have a personal way into the story, tell it. Mm-hmm. Because when we have a personal story that we share, we can't help but become more animated. When you and I were talking at the beginning about our experiences at J. Walter Thompson, we were probably both smiling. If we were looking at each other, our eyes would be sparkling, might be glinting a little bit, because when we talk about an emotional experience, we feel it more, a personal experience. And then when we feel it, we convey it to the person who's listening to us tell that story.
Yeah, we're thinking about the Park Avenue atrium, that the building where we worked.
Literally thinking about that and WrestleMania in that atrium and all the other crazy things that happened there in the 80s. The point is that I'm in that story and then I bring you into the story. So how do you do that if you're serving a customer that isn't you? Right. Let's say you're building the product for you, then it's easy. You could say, this is something I'm going through. But what if you're building it for someone else that you know? One of my favorite stories is about a guy building a product, and he started his presentation by saying, "My parents are deaf. My sister is deaf." That's the very first thing he says. Mm-hmm. And already I'm fascinated, like, what's it like growing up in that family? And I could see the emotion in his face as he's talking about this life that he lived growing up. And then he says, I know how hard it is growing up in a deaf family to have a group conversation. He said, if you're looking over here and he looks one way and you're watching someone speak, even if you can read lips, if someone says something on the other side of the room, you miss it. And that's how he opens his presentation. And because he's describing an experience that it wasn't his, he's not deaf, but he's describing an experience that his family had. I'm feeling that as if I'm him sitting at the table or I'm that family member sitting at the table.
Yes,
who's trying to struggle to keep up.
I felt the frustration reading the story.
Yeah. And that's what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
That you want to make your audience feel that frustration. So telling a personal story is great. And it could be someone, if it's not you and it's not a family member, talk about meeting the customer. In the story that I told you about Ben and Maya, I talked about working with Ben and Maya personally and how they then worked and talked to the customers. And if they were pitching it, they'd say, oh my God, you wouldn't believe the faces of these customers who had to use Craigslist to hire. I could feel it right now. They were pounding the table. And now you're telling your personal story of hearing the customer speak. So you don't always have that tool in your toolkit to you can't always, pull that arrow out of your quiver, at least to use that metaphor. But
a lot of people overlook that.
Yeah, don't overlook it. It's really, mm-hmm. really great. And another thing to think about that is in the first story is vertical takeoff. Right. And this is a great thing for salespeople to remember. It's a great thing for marketers to remember is just grab people right away. Start right at the beginning and with something that they're going to be like, oh, wow, I have to hear this story now. And
yes.
He literally started with my parents are deaf. My sister is deaf. That's called a vertical takeoff. And when you think about movies that start with a chase scene, why do you think they're starting with a chase scene? It's to get you agitated and to get you like leaning forward and going, oh my God, this is going to be a crazy movie. And now you're sort of right into it. So think about that vertical takeoff to grab people right away from the get-go. So those are two ways of making sure you have some emotion. But the main thing is just make sure you bring the customer into the room.
Yes.
It's essential that your audience meet your customer in some way, shape, or form. And sometimes you can literally bring them in the room because you're the customer, or there's someone else in the room who is the customer, or maybe you have a video. But maybe you're just a good storyteller, and you help people understand what that customer is going through.
Right. And if the first slide is a picture of your factory, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. You know, I often tell people, if you want people to, quote unquote, stick around for the story and you don't want to lose them, maybe start with some big picture vision of how the world's going to be better with your product in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm building a product. Let's go back to Pranoti's example. I'm building a product that is going to help young professional Indians living overseas to connect with their culture and bring their kids and their families back in close to their culture. And it's going to be something that's so important for these non-resident Indians, something like at a high level. And now I'm going to zoom all the way in, imagine yourself at 30,000 feet. I'm now going to zoom all the way into Times Square and find one person who I'm going to tell the story about. And then people will go along with you for the story because they know it's worth waiting to find out how are you going to help these millions of people living around the world connect with their culture. I'll stick around to find out.
How does it end?
Right. Now I'm in Times Square and I'm meeting Aditi, who, is an engineer working at a company in New York City, but she's feeling this longing. And now I'm telling a DT story and the customer's brought in the room.
Ah, terrific. So I mentioned earlier, memorable, compelling, and clear. Let's talk about compelling. On page 96, you write, there are many ways to get your audience nodding and thinking, oh, this makes sense. To make your story compelling, always be sure to connect the dots. Set up the story and pay it off. Your narrative must make sense. So, David, what are some of the ways? I mean, what are some of the best ways to make a story logical? I guess we all think our own stories are logical. I guess what are some of the biggest mistakes that are made as it relates to keeping a story from being logical?
Well, even I'm going to just step back a hair before I answer your question to reinforce why this is so important. Think about any movie you've seen or book you've read, fictional, or even a nonfiction, you know, historical nonfiction or whatever, where you get to the ending and it doesn't quite pay it off. You're not happy with the ending, right? It's like you heard about all this stuff that the protagonist was dealing with and it's not resolved at the end.
Right.
It doesn't feel good, right?
We
want things, and even if something, even if in a beautifully told story is a little bit, it's not quite clear what's happening. If you think hard enough, you could sort of, if you can understand the arc of the story, you'll be satisfied. Likewise, in these innovation narratives, we have to be able to make sure if we've introduced some issues up front, that when we get to the back end of the story of the product, that we've actually solved the problems we've introduced. And likewise, if I'm solving things when I describe the product at the back end, I needed to set them up at the beginning. So there's this logical counterpoint where I've set it up and I've paid it off. So the simplest way to make sure you do that is to just be mindful of the fact that if I introduce certain aspects of the struggle that the character, the protagonist has in the story, the customer, then I need to describe how the product solves those issues. Right?
So it's not like you're watching a movie and at the end you go, wait, but whatever happened to so-and-so?
Yeah, right, exactly. So if, for example, I'm talking about, let's go back to the Uber example, and I'm talking about the rider part of the story, and I say, you know, I hate the fact that I never know if the cab is really coming when I've ordered a cab or if a cab is going to come by. There's no certainty around that. And I don't know if the driver is going to be good or if the cab's going to be clean. And paying is hard. And I don't know if I'm going to have cash or whether they're going to take credit cards. So those are all questions, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, when I describe the solution, I have to say, well, guess what? Drivers are rated. You have a map. You know exactly where they are and when they're going to get there. It's already paid through the app that you've set up so that the payment happens automatically. Well, I just set it up and I paid it off. So that is the simplest way to make sure the logic is working, is to just make sure that the dots connect on that. Another thing to do is to maybe create an antagonist in your story. You know, people can follow a story where it's like, here is the enemy. This is everything. You know, the Salesforce was great at this, right?
Yes.
In the early days, there's a famous example where they would literally send people to Microsoft conferences and stand outside actors with placards, with a big circle, red circle around something that it said software and a red line through the word software. So the antagonist in their story was software. Here's all the things that are terrible about you having software in your shop on your devices. Wouldn't it be great if the software lives somewhere else and someone else worried about maintaining it and updating it and you just accessed it to use it? And that was where they introduced the notion of software in the cloud. That was the early cloud people. And suddenly the cloud was the antidote to software. So if I can create an antagonist in my story, it just logically follows that, well, we're not that. We're something very different. And again, Uber, the antagonist was taxis, and you know, the examples are endless, but it's a very good logical way to make sure your audience understands what problem you're trying to solve.
Ah, yes. So again, memorable, compelling, and clear. So let's talk about the last one, clarity. Page 108. You're right. This is the chapter on make your story understandable. You're right. Half of the art of telling an understandable story is deciding which parts to leave out. It's almost like you could have had a sculpture degree. So in addition to, you know, maybe cutting down our story, what are things that people can do or should do to make their story more understandable and clear?
Yeah, well, you know, the famous Mark Twain quote, I would have written a short letter, but I didn't have the time.
Yeah, I love right? it. Yeah, and I think you had that in the book, didn't you?
Yes,
as an example. Exactly. I see what you did there.
Yeah. See what I did there? And the whole idea of that, this is actually hard, right? It's easy to write a long letter. Just write page after page after page. You don't have to edit anything. So the first lesson here is it takes time. You know, write the story and then constantly pare back and think, what at the core is the arc of the story? And that's what I go back to. And in building that core story arc, here's this customer, they're struggling with these things. Here's what we're going to solve for them, et cetera, going through all those elements, but don't leave out the thing that has the emotional resonance. Mm. Don't leave out the thing that will really land with people. And I remember working with a startup founder named Steve Derrico, who was trying to tell the story of a product called Dottie, which he was building for cancer patients who were navigating through managing their cancer, or caregivers managing through the cancer treatment care of someone that they loved. And in talking to him, one of the conversations he said to me, you know, having cancer is like a full-time job. And then he went on to something else. I said, whoa, 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 back up. I said, that is such a powerful statement that that really hit me on my core. I mean, mm-hmm. I know how hard it is to have one full-time job. So having two, or knowing that I can't work and then I have to have this be my full-time job, is devastating. So if you build your narrative around that, I am going to be so rooting for you to make this not a full-time job by coming up with a platform that helps the patient navigate the insurance and the doctor treatments and the follow-up and all the stuff that they have to manage as a cancer patient. And the point is, that's something that is essential for the story. And as you peel other things away, don't lose that, because that's the thing that really makes me feel what's going on. And so anyway, and the other part of this is, make sure you can tell your core product story in 1 to 2 minutes. It shouldn't take more than 1 to 2 minutes to describe who your customer is and what they're trying to accomplish and why it's hard and what the value proposition is going to be of the problem that you're solving and how the product works and how it's better than the competition. Get that down to 1 to 2 minutes, but leave in that really magical stuff like, you know, it's like having a full-time job to be a cancer patient.
Mm, terrific. Yeah, there's lots of them in there, like creating an analog and be brief, keep its story simple.
Well, the analog's a favorite one for me because it's so telegraphic, and it's a great way to get to, you know, to
not have to describe. Well, say some more about that, because honestly, that was probably my favorite. I don't want the other sections to feel jealous, but you talked about Dropbox and even the Rotomatic.
Yeah, well, the Rotomatic, I'll never forget. She said, you know, you may not know what a Rode is, but this device would be kind of like what a rice maker is to other communities. And yes. I was like, oh, I get that. I know that there are whole communities of people who have a rice maker in their house because culturally they have rice with most every meal. And just that one analog completely helped me understand the potential power of that device. So there's lots of examples. That was one of my favorite ones. The example that Dropbox originally had, you referenced that as well.
Yeah.
Was they said, imagine if you could have a magic pocket. You know, you're somewhere where you left your wallet at home, or your keys at home, or your sunglasses, or your reading glasses, which happens to me all the time, and you just wish you could reach into a magic pocket and that thing you left in your house was there. Well, that's what Dropbox is for your files. They're always with you wherever you are. Wherever you can access any device, you can get to your files in the same way you could maybe, if you had a magic pocket, you could get anything you left in your house. And it's such a vivid analog that I go, okay, now get what Dropbox is, even if at the time when they launched it many years ago, I had no clue what they were talking about.
Mm. Well, just three other questions about the book. The Marketing Book Podcast has listeners in over 160 countries now. So could you please talk about which cultures storytelling doesn't work well in?
Well, that would be zero.
Did you hear that, everybody?
And it's funny because I often have people say, well, I'm blank. You know, I'm German. That's one I've heard more than once. You know, we don't tell stories in Germany. like, no. Every culture has storytelling, and you're a human being, and all humans respond to story. We cannot not respond to story, I guess, unless we're a sociopath or something, right?
Uh-huh.
So it works in every culture, and yet there are certain cultures that it's a little bit more challenging to convince people that they should use storytelling. But you could, in any culture, you can find great examples of great storytellers who've literally separated themselves by being great storytellers.
Terrific. So we've got our story. We're getting some traction. How do we know when our story is finished?
Well, it's not, because we can always evolve and refresh the story. It's more like a play than a film. You know, a film, you get a final version of the film and it's in the can and it's done, Right. Uh-huh. I mean, there might be an editor's cut somewhere, but for all intents and purposes, that thing is done and it's locked. But if you're sharing the story of your product and service with people in the form of talking about it in front of a room or creating a version of the story on your website, whatever that is, that's an evolving living organism. And based on feedback you get, like, oh, this part of the story is great. Tell me more about that. Amplify that part of the story. Or I don't understand this part of the story. Help me understand that. You can constantly refine and fine tune your story so that it just always gets better based on feedback you get from your audience. And there are several examples in the book of people who have constantly refined and evolved their stories based on hearing people respond to them.
Right. So let's not carve those stories in stone. It also reminds me of the stand-up comedians who are just never stopping when it comes to working on their material based on audience feedback and so forth. So
Yeah. And it could be as little as, and to me, that's a fantastic example. It could be as little as how long they paused after something, mm-hmm. or the word they used, or a turn of phrase, or a part of the story that they moved. Like we in the Pixar example with Finding Nemo, where they move something from the end of the film to the beginning of the film. And there again, Pixar is a great example. They spent 4 years constantly evolving the story. So even though they ultimately put it in the can, there's this very, very long gestation process where they're constantly tweaking and looking for making the story resonate more.
Yes, and I think one could argue Pixar knows stories.
They're pretty good.
I mean, and they work on
billion-dollar films. Yeah. They're that have these massive audience followings because they do such a great job of telling a story.
Yes. Okay, so this is the last question about specifically about the book. On page 31, you write that smart researchers know how to ask one last question before ending an interview. Quote, is there anything else you'd like to tell me? So, David Reamer, is there anything else you'd like to tell me?
Just put the work in, right? To me, this is something that some people say, well, I'm not naturally that great a storyteller. I mean, I have friends who are, but that's not me. Well, it's like anything. You can actually, if you put the work in, you can actually become better as a storyteller, every single one of us. Because guess what? We all know what a story is, right? We've all sat at our parents' feet or our caregivers' feet and listened to them tell us a story. We've watched movies. All we did for 2 years was watch television shows and streaming shows. All we've been doing is consuming stories for 2 years. So the point being, we know what a story is. And with a little bit of help, which this book was literally written as a guidebook to guide you through the process, you can know what the elements are, and you can have some techniques that can help you tell them in ways that are emotional and compelling, and just work on it, because we all have it in us, and we can all get better.
That is such a great answer, and there have been three books on the show over the years about creativity, and all of them pierce the myth of lightning in a bottle. It's really
hard work.
It's work. It's hard. It's getting up, doing it over and over. It's about a work ethic, and the same applies to this. So, David, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
The customer is the protagonist in your story. Mm. Use storytelling as a way to force yourself to think about the customer, get in the head of the customer, empathize with the customer, so to make sure that, first of all, you're building the right thing for them. And then secondly, when you're trying to compel them to buy your product, you're trying to compel someone to invest in you to build the product, that you're starting with this notion of, I know who the protagonist is, and I'm going to build a compelling story around them.
Mm, such a great anchor or linchpin for strategy and so many other things. And it reminds me of the empty chair in Jeff Bezos' conference room. Great, great answer. Let's give the listener one thing they could do today, just to get them moving in this direction, thinking about this, putting in action one of the ideas from your book before it arrives.
Yeah, I mean, I think they should, quote unquote, talk to their customer.
Oh, and amen.
And not necessarily, I mean, they may not be able to literally pick up the phone and talk to their customer, although if they can do that, that would be great. And go online and watch that Grace Reese's Puffs commercial before they do it.
I'll include it in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com.
There you go. But just the idea that, okay, maybe I'm not going to go literally talk to them today, but I'm going to go back and look at that research again, or I'm going to think about interactions in the past I've had with a customer, and I'm going to try and think about, is there something really innately human in how they're interacting with this product or service. Let's say I'm making an espresso, Nespresso, and I'm thinking about telling that story. Have I really thought about how my customer relates to that moment in the day where they make the espresso for themselves? What's going on right before that? And then what is that experience like for them to sip that espresso while they're looking out their window and figuring out what they're going to do that day? Or what is that routine like, and what role does it play in their whole day? You know, do that. Get in the head of your customer either through research, through reflection, or through literally talking to your customer.
Oh, that is such great advice. And there have been so many just fantastic books on this podcast over the years where the whole linchpin is about understanding your customers even just a little bit better than your competition. And pro tip, don't go to them and say, well, what do you want? Observe them. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Observe them. Yeah. Right. Observe them and look, what is that thing that's just human? One more illustration of this that I think is kind of informative, because especially for people working on very technical products in a B2B setting, one of the stories I talk about in the book is working with a company called Databricks. Started with Databricks when there were three people in a conference room, two grad students and a professor. And that was like 8 years ago in downtown Berkeley. That company is now valued at $38 billion. And what we got at was understanding what is it like to be a data scientist in a fast-growing company, usually a digital company that's relying on tons and tons of data about customer interactions. And what we discovered from those conversations was that for that customer, there was this massive gap in expectations. The people who run the company had invested a gazillion dollars in storing data, and then they hired these data scientists and said, hey, go find me that business insight that will let me crush the competition. Go do that. And they go back to their desks, and because of the way the data is organized, they spend all their time writing software programs to try and access the data, and then running the programs as it operated, running through the data. And they never got a chance to work on the insights. So they're constantly being beat up for not meeting the expectations. And that thing is a very human thing. Anybody can understand being in a position where the expectations for your work are extremely high, and yet your hands are tied behind your back, and you're not able to even come close to executing those expectations. So the point is, look for that innately human thing that anybody can understand. And Databricks did a lot of other great things that got them to be this massive company today.
Well, besides work with you.
Yeah, but really, it was, you know, it's nice to have a good story.
Yes.
Because it's a huge part of building fans and building supporters and all of that when you're getting started.
There was a new book on the show recently called What Customers Hate. And part of the idea in the book, but it's by Nick Webb, he talks about just go find out what your customers hate. It might not be you, but there's some frustration, just like the example you gave earlier about the small business frustration of trying to hire employees on Craigslist. Find out what they hate. Or there was another book on the show a couple of years ago called Friction. There is friction out there, folks. Just you can find it.
Right. I love the title, because it hate is a powerful word.
Oh.
And you will find that people do hate things, and things that don't seem like that big a deal. One of my favorite hate stories in the book is the Huggies story, right? Remember that one?
Yes.
Where they were doing interviews in people's homes, ethnographic research. This is Huggies. This is a business that all they ever did around innovation was to make the diapers wick moisture better, because that's what you'd do if you were a company that made diapers, right? Uh-huh. You'd work in the technology. Well, they went into people's homes, and they started hearing this thing over and over again from parents whose children were going through potty training. These parents were saying, God, you know what I hate? And they'd lean in and they'd say, I hate it when people look at me and they say haughtily, oh, your kid's still in diapers?
Yes.
And they felt terrible about that, because it was like, am I a bad parent? My kid's not out of diapers yet. They're still in diapers. This is awful. So Huggies was like, ah, we need to give them something that's not a better diaper. We need to make underwear that serves as a diaper. And they created Huggies pull-ups so that they could tell that person, oh no, they're not in diapers anymore. They're in pull-ups, right? And that one insight led to a $1 billion business. And it was because Huggies figured out what those people hated.
Yeah.
It was the antagonist in the story. So I love the title of that book. And it's a super smart way in to understand, get at these customer insights.
Oh, well, David, looking back, what books have most inspired your work and career?
Well, it's interesting. As I reflected on this, I thought, you know what? A booklet was a really important part of my sort of marketing journey, and that was the Thompson Way. If you think about as when we were growing up through J. Walter Thompson, there was a way that we worked through things, and we actually had a booklet that we went through.
It was like a binder,
and,
as I recall.
Yeah, it was a binder, and it literally, we went through training back in the day.
Yes.
And we learned how to do the things that we do in advertising. And frankly, so much of what I'm doing now is just coming up with a slightly different framework from what I learned then, and as I learned as a product marketer when I became a client, and I sort of put some of those elements together. But that book was really formative for me, or that booklet, and that approach. There are storytelling books that have been very inspiring to me because that's the area I've decided to focus on. Mm-hmm. As a marketing professional, Tell to Win is a great book by Peter Guber, who wrote, who's actually been a big executive in Hollywood and owns sports teams like the Warriors and the Dodgers. He talks about how successful people have been in life by just being great storytellers. So it's very inspirational. It's like, wow, yeah, I want to be successful. How have these other people been successful as storytellers? So that one was compelling. There's a book called Story, which is about how films are created. And it's interesting to sort of read in an art form how story structure works. So some of those books are really helpful in my sort of storytelling career. And now I'm really focused on books that help me understand how to build a narrative. And we talked about a couple of others here, Lisa Cron's book, Jonathan Gottschall's book. Those are all really nice storytelling books for those who are interested in this subject.
Yes. And there were even other books that you mentioned throughout yours. One thought that I have, though, is that when you talk about the Thompson Way, one reason it probably had a big impact on you and me is it because it wasn't just reading it, it was applying it repeatedly.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. It was fantastic in that way because you get to practice.
Yes.
Right? Those applications were practice. And so, you know, what's that one thing you can do, right? So go out, start talking to customers. And the very next thing after discovering that really compelling insight that you never discovered before is rewrite your narrative. Or maybe use this format and write it for the first time, centering on that customer discovery. And maybe there'll be some new things that sort of help you find a way either to improve what you're building or talk about it in a more exciting and memorable way.
Absolutely. Well, now that you've written your book, you have time to put your head up. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard about or are looking forward to reading?
Well, this is a complete sort of left turn from a marketing book, but I think it's important as marketers.
Well, I said any recent or upcoming book, so it doesn't have to be a business book.
Yeah, exactly. So I just read a book called The Sixth Man. I'm a big sports fan, and it's a book by Andre Iguodala, the Warriors star. And the reason why I think it's compelling and worth talking about is it's really the first book that I've read from a black athlete that talks about what it's like to be a black athlete, an African-American athlete in 2022. And I think it's so important as we focus more on being inclusive as leaders in marketing and sales, that we find new avenues to sort of understand perspectives of people and maybe see things a little different and think about our customers differently if their life experience is different than ours. And it was such a fascinating take on what it's really like to be in the shoes of a professional athlete who's African American today that it just gave me a bigger sort of insight into folks that we need to spend more time thinking about what their life experience is. Anybody who's had a different experience than me. And I think that makes us a better marketer. So just from an insight perspective, I really like that book.
Oh, absolutely. Andre Iguodala?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I'm looking at it on Amazon right here. It looks really very interesting. Well, I appreciate you mentioning that. Well, as I mentioned before, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, to David's website, to his LinkedIn profile, to his Twitter account. And here's why I'm going to include all those links, because I want to ask the listener a big, big favor. Please reach out to David and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Congratulate him on the book. Thank him for putting up with really stupid juvenile jokes. I mean, David, flying colors, you got there. But please reach out, because the authors just love hearing from people who listen to the interview and have questions. And as I like to say, you know, David seems like a really nice guy. I bet he'll answer your questions. So continue the conversation, reach out to David, say hello, and I would really appreciate it. Final quote, page 172. Now it's your turn. You've learned why story is essential. You've seen how to build a narrative. You've heard how to tell an emotional, clear, and compelling story. You've considered some classic story frameworks, and you know where to take your story next. Now the fun part starts. It's time to develop your great innovation story and then tell the world. It's time for you to get your startup story straight. The book is Get Your Startup Story Straight, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs. The author is David Reamer. David, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Doug. It was really a hoot to get back together with you again and to talk about it. Thanks.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."